Antiquities, Book 13. How Jonathan, Judas's brother, took over the leadership when Judas died. How, warring against Bacchides, he forced him to make friendship with him and leave the country. That Alexander, son of Antiochus Epiphanes, came to Syria and made war on Demetrius. How Demetrius sent envoys to Jonathan and made an alliance with him, giving many gifts both to him and to our nation. How Alexander, hearing of this and outbidding Demetrius's offers, made Jonathan high priest and persuaded him to become his ally. The friendship of Onias with Ptolemy Philometor, which arose at the same time, and how he built the temple called Onias's Temple, modeled on the one in Jerusalem. That Alexander, after Demetrius died, honored Jonathan greatly. How Demetrius, son of Demetrius, sailed to Syria from Crete, made war on Alexander, defeated him, and became king himself, making friendship with Jonathan. How Trypho of Apamea, having defeated Demetrius in war, handed the kingdom over to Antiochus, son of Alexander, and made Jonathan his own ally as well. How, when Demetrius was taken captive by the Parthians, Trypho broke faith with Jonathan, seized him by treachery, killed him, and made war on his brother Simon. How the nation entrusted the command to Simon, Jonathan's brother, and appointed him high priest. How he besieged Trypho at Dora, having become the ally of Antiochus, brother of Demetrius, who was surnamed Eusebs. How, after Trypho was put to death, Antiochus made war on Simon, and Simon, defeating his general Cendebeus, drove him out of Judea. That Simon was murdered by treachery at a banquet by his son-in-law Ptolemy, and Ptolemy, having bound Simon's wife and children, tried to seize the government for himself. How Hyrcanus, the youngest of Simon's sons, got ahead of him, took over the leadership, and besieged Ptolemy, shutting him up in a fortress called Dagon. How Antiochus, called Eusebs, campaigned against Hyrcanus, and having sat down before the city of Jerusalem, broke off the siege after taking 300 talents from Hyrcanus and concluding an alliance and friendship with him. Hyrcanus's campaign into Syria after the death of Antiochus, who died among the Medes, and how he took many cities by force. The friendship with Hyrcanus of Alexander, called Zabinas. How Antiochus Cyzicenus, defeated by Hyrcanus, was driven out of Judea. How Aristobulus, on taking over the rule, was the first to put on a diadem. How, after Aristobulus died, his brother Alexander took over the rule, campaigned into Syria, Phoenicia, and Arabia, and subdued many of the nations. The battle and victory of Ptolemy Lathyrus against him. How Demetrius, called Eucharis, campaigned against Alexander and defeated him. The campaign of Antiochus, also called Dionysus, against Judea, and how he prevailed in the battle. How, after Alexander's death, his wife Alexandra held the kingdom for 9 years, and having lived out her life in peace and honor, died. This book covers a period of 82 years. In what manner, then, the Jewish nation, once the Macedonians had enslaved it, recovered its freedom, and through how many and how great struggles its general Judas went forth and died fighting on their behalf, we have shown in the book before this one. After the death of Judas, everything among the Jews that was still impious and had transgressed the ancestral constitution sprang up and, flourishing on every side, afflicted them. Famine joined forces with their wickedness and seized the land as well, so that many, for want of necessities and unable to hold out against the twin terrors of famine and enemy, deserted to the Macedonians. Bacchides gathered together those Jews who had abandoned the ancestral way of life and preferred the common cause with the enemy, and entrusted to them the oversight of the country. These men seized Judas's friends and those loyal to his cause and handed them over to Bacchides, who first tortured them and abused them for his pleasure before putting them to death in this way. Since so great a calamity had befallen the Jews, of a kind they had not experienced since their return from Babylon, the surviving companions of Judas, seeing the nation perishing so pitiably, came to his brother Jonathan and asked him to imitate his brother and the concern he had shown for their kinsmen, who had died for their freedom, and not to allow the nation to go without a leader nor to be destroyed further. Jonathan said he was ready to die on their behalf, and being judged in no way inferior to his brother, was appointed general of the Jews. Bacchides, hearing this, was afraid that Jonathan, like Judas before him, would cause trouble for the king and the Macedonians, and sought to kill him by treachery. This intention of his did not escape Jonathan or his brother Simon. Learning of it, they took all their companions and fled at once into the wilderness nearest the city, and coming to the water called the Cistern of Asphar, they stayed there. Bacchides, perceiving that they had gone off and were in that place, set out against them with his whole force, and, encamping beyond the Jordan, let his troops rest. Jonathan, learning that Bacchides was coming against him, sent his brother John, also called Gades, to the Nabatean Arabs, so that he might deposit their baggage with them until they had fought Bacchides, for the Nabateans were their friends. But as John was going to the Nabateans, the sons of Amorius, out of the city of Medaba, ambushed him, seized him and those with him, plundered everything he was carrying, and killed John and all his companions. They paid a fitting penalty for this to his brothers, however, which we shall relate shortly. Bacchides, learning that Jonathan was encamped in the marshes of the Jordan, watched for the Sabbath day and came against him on it, supposing he would not fight because of the law. But Jonathan roused his companions, telling them that their very lives were at stake, hemmed in as they were between the river and the enemy with no way to flee, for the enemy were advancing in front and the river was behind them, and, praying that God would grant them victory, he joined battle with the enemy. Having cut down many of them, when he saw Bacchides boldly bearing down on him, he stretched out his right hand as if to strike him. But Bacchides saw it coming and dodged the blow, and Jonathan leapt away with his companions and swam across the river. And in this manner, they made their escape to the other side of the Jordan, since the enemy no longer crossed the river after Bacchides at once turned back to the citadel in Jerusalem. He had lost about 2,000 of his army. Bacchides then took and fortified many cities of Judea, Jericho, Emmaus, Beth-horon, Bethel, Timnath, Pharatho, Tochoa, and Gazara, and building towers in each of the cities and surrounding them with strong and remarkably large walls, he stationed a garrison in them, so that his men, setting out from there, could harass the Jews. Above all, he fortified the citadel in Jerusalem. He also took the sons of the leading men of Judea as hostages and shut them up in the citadel, and kept watch over them in this way. At the same time, someone came to Jonathan and his brother Simon and reported that the sons of Amorius were celebrating a marriage and bringing the bride from the city of Nabatha, the daughter of one of the notable men among the Arabs, and that a splendid and lavish procession for the girl was about to take place. Jonathan and Simon, thinking this the most fitting occasion to avenge their brother, and supposing they could exact justice for John from these men with great advantage, set out for Medaba and lay in ambush, waiting in the mountain for their enemies. When they saw them bringing the bride and the bridegroom, along with the crowd of friends that naturally accompanies a wedding, they leapt out of the ambush and killed them all, and, taking the jewelry and all the other plunder that then accompanied the people, withdrew. And so they exacted vengeance for their brother John from the sons of Amorius in this way. These men themselves, along with the friends who had joined them, and their wives and children, perished, 400 in all. Simon and Jonathan then withdrew to the marshes of the river and stayed there. Bacchides, having secured all of Judea with garrisons, returned to the king, and for 2 years the affairs of the Jews remained at peace. But the fugitives and the impious, seeing Jonathan and his companions living in the country in great security because of the peace, sent to King Demetrius, urging him to send Bacchides to capture Jonathan, for they claimed it could be done without effort, and that by falling upon them in a single night, while they did not expect it, he could kill them all. The king sent Bacchides, who, on arriving in Judea, wrote to all his friends and to the Jews and allies to seize Jonathan for him. But though all made every effort, they could not get hold of Jonathan, for he was on his guard, having learned of the plot. Bacchides, enraged at the fugitives for having deceived both himself and the king, seized 50 of their leaders and put them to death. Jonathan, together with his brother and their companions, withdrew, out of fear of Bacchides, to Bethlehem, a village in the wilderness, and building towers and surrounding himself with walls, kept himself securely guarded. Bacchides, hearing of this, took the army with him, along with the Jewish allies he gathered, and came against Jonathan, and, attacking his fortifications, besieged him for many days. But Jonathan did not yield to the pressure of the siege. Standing firm, he left his brother Simon behind in the town to fight Bacchides, while he himself slipped out secretly into the country, and, gathering a large force from those loyal to him, fell by night upon Bacchides' camp, and, destroying a great many of them, made himself known to his brother Simon as well by falling upon the enemy. For Simon, perceiving that the enemy were being killed by Jonathan, sallied out against them too, burned the siege engines of the Macedonians, and inflicted heavy slaughter on them. Bacchides, seeing himself hemmed in by the enemy, with some pressing him from the front and others from behind, fell into despondency and confusion of mind, thrown into disorder by this unexpected turn against the siege. He vented his anger over this on the fugitives who had summoned him from the king, as men who had deceived him, and wished, if possible, to bring the siege to an honorable end and return home. Learning his intention, Jonathan sent envoys to him concerning friendship and alliance, so that they might restore to each other the prisoners each side had taken. Bacchides, judging this the most honorable way to withdraw, made a treaty of friendship with Jonathan, and they swore no longer to campaign against one another. And having returned the prisoners and recovered his own men, he went back to Antioch to the king, and after this withdrawal he never again invaded Judea. Jonathan, taking hold of this peace and making his residence in the town of Michmash, governed the people there, punishing the wicked and impious, and so cleansing the nation of them. In the 160th year, it happened that Alexander, son of Antiochus Epiphanes, went up to Syria and took Ptolemais by the treachery of the soldiers within it. For they held Demetrius in hatred because of his arrogance and his unwillingness to be approached. For he had shut himself up in a royal residence with four towers, which he had built himself not far from Antioch, and admitted no one, but was careless and negligent about affairs, so that the hatred of his subjects toward him blazed up all the more, as we have already shown elsewhere. Demetrius, hearing that Alexander had arrived at Ptolemais, gathered his whole army and led it against him. He also sent envoys to Jonathan concerning alliance and goodwill, for he had resolved to forestall Alexander, lest, without prior negotiation with him, Alexander should secure his help instead. He did this out of fear that Jonathan, remembering old grievances against him, might join in the hostilities against him. He therefore ordered him to gather a force, prepare weapons, and recover the hostages whom Bacchides had shut up from among the Jews in the citadel of Jerusalem. When this message from Demetrius reached him, Jonathan came to Jerusalem and read the king's letter aloud in the hearing of the people and of those guarding the citadel. When it had been read, the impious men and fugitives from the citadel were greatly afraid, since the king had entrusted Jonathan with gathering an army and recovering the hostages. Jonathan gave each hostage back to his own parents. And so Jonathan made his residence in Jerusalem, renewing the state of the city and arranging everything according to his own wishes. He ordered the walls of the city to be rebuilt with squared stones, so that they would be more secure against attacks. When the guards of the fortresses in Judea saw this, they all abandoned their posts and fled to Antioch, except those in the town of Bethsura and those in the citadel of Jerusalem. For these were mostly impious and fugitive Jews, and for that reason they did not abandon their garrisons. When Alexander learned of the promises Demetrius had made to Jonathan, and of Jonathan's courage and all he had accomplished in fighting the Macedonians, and again of all he himself had suffered at the hands of Demetrius and of Bacchides, Demetrius's general, he said that in the present circumstances, one could not find a better ally for one's friends than Jonathan, a man who was both brave in war and bore a personal hatred toward Demetrius after all he had suffered, and had suffered many wrongs at his hands. If then, it seemed good to make him a friend against Demetrius, now was no less useful a moment than any other to invite him into the alliance. This resolved, Alexander and his friends decided to send to Jonathan, and he wrote him the following letter: King Alexander to his brother Jonathan, greetings. We have long heard of your courage and loyalty, and for this reason we have sent to you concerning friendship and alliance. We hereby appoint you high priest of the Jews today, and you are to be called our friend. He sent him gifts as well, a purple robe and a golden crown, and urged him, now that he had been honored by us, to become likewise disposed toward us. When Jonathan received the letter, he put on the priestly robe at the coming Feast of Tabernacles, 4 years after his brother Judas had died, for not even during that time had anyone become high priest. He gathered a large force and had a great quantity of weapons forged. Demetrius, on learning of this, was greatly distressed, and blamed himself for his slowness, in that he had not forestalled Alexander by showing kindness to Jonathan himself, but had left the occasion open to him. He too, therefore, wrote a letter to Jonathan and to the people, declaring the following: King Demetrius to Jonathan and to the nation of the Jews, greetings. Since you have preserved your friendship toward us, and have not gone over to my enemies though they tested you, we commend you for this loyalty and urge you to remain in the same course, and you shall receive rewards and favors from us in return. I will release most of you from the taxes and the tributes which you used to pay to the kings before me and to me, and I now remit to you the taxes you have always paid. In addition, I grant you exemption from the tax on salt and from the crowns you used to offer us, and instead of a third of the grain and half of the fruit of the trees, the portion that fell to me, I remit to you from this day forward. And as to the tax due to me for each head of those dwelling in Judea, and for the three toparchies attached to Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and Perea, these I concede to you from now for all time. And I wish the city of Jerusalem to be holy and inviolable, and free, together with its territory, from the tithe and from the tolls. I also grant the citadel to your high priest Jonathan, that he may station in it as guards whomever he judges trustworthy and friendly, so that they may keep it for us. And I release free all Jews who have been taken captive and are enslaved in our realm. I also order that the beasts of burden belonging to Jews not be requisitioned for forced service, and that the Sabbaths and every festival, together with 3 days before each festival, be exempt from taxation. In the same way, I release free and unmolested the Jews dwelling within my realm, and I permit those who wish to serve in my army to do so, up to 30,000 in number, and these shall receive the same allowances my own army receives. Some of them I will station in the garrisons, others about the guard of my own person, and I will make some of them commanders among those of my court. I also permit them to live by their ancestral laws and to keep them, and I wish them to be subject to the three districts attached to Judea in accordance with those laws. I also charge the high priest to see to it that no Jew has any other temple to worship at except the one in Jerusalem alone. And out of my own funds, I give 15,000 shekels yearly toward the expense of the sacrifices, and whatever surplus of the money remains, I wish it to be yours. And the 10,000 drachmas which the kings used to take from the temple, I remit to you, since they properly belong to the priests who serve in the temple. And whoever takes refuge at the temple in Jerusalem, or within its precincts, whether owing money to the royal treasury or for any other cause, let these be released, and let their property remain secure. I also permit the renewing and rebuilding of the temple, the expense for this being met out of my own funds, and I likewise grant that the walls of the city be rebuilt, and that high towers be raised, this too at my own expense. And if there is any fortress that it is advantageous for the country of the Jews to have made secure, let this too be built at my expense. With these promises and favors, Demetrius wrote to the Jews. But King Alexander, having gathered a large force of mercenaries and of the soldiers who had joined him from Syria, marched against Demetrius. And when battle was joined, the left wing of Demetrius's army routed the enemy opposite it and pursued them a great distance, killing many of them and plundering their camp. But the right wing, where Demetrius himself happened to be, was defeated. All the rest fled, but Demetrius, fighting nobly, killed no small number of the enemy, and while pursuing the others drove his horse into a deep and impassable swamp, where it happened that his horse fell and he, unable to escape, was killed there. For the enemy, seeing what had happened to him, turned back and, surrounding Demetrius, all hurled their javelins at him. He, fighting on foot, defended himself nobly, but at last, having received many wounds and no longer able to hold out, he fell. Such was the end that overtook Demetrius, who had reigned 11 years, as we have also shown elsewhere. Now the son of Onias the high priest, who bore the same name as his father, and who, as we have said before, had fled to Alexandria, and was living there with King Ptolemy called Philometor, when he saw Judea being mistreated by the Macedonians and their kings, wishing to secure for himself glory and everlasting remembrance, resolved to send to King Ptolemy and to Queen Cleopatra, and ask their permission to build a temple in Egypt like the one in Jerusalem, and to install Levites and priests of his own people. He was moved to this above all by his confidence in the prophet Isaiah, who, having lived more than 600 years before, had foretold that a temple must certainly be built in Egypt to the Most High God by a Jewish man. Moved by these considerations, then, Onias wrote the following letter to Ptolemy and Cleopatra. "Having rendered you many great services in matters of war, with God's help, and having been present in Celesyria and Phoenicia, and having come with the Jews to the city of Leontopolis in the Heliopolite Nome and to other places of the nation, and finding that most of them had shrines that were not fitting, and were for this reason at odds with one another. A thing that has also happened to the Egyptians, because of the multitude of their shrines, and the disagreement among them over their forms of worship. I found a most suitable place in the fortress called that of the wild Bubastes, abounding in varied timber and full of sacred animals. And I ask that I be permitted to cleanse this ownerless and ruined shrine, and to build there a temple to the Most High God, modeled after the one in Jerusalem and of the same dimensions, on behalf of you and your wife and your children, so that the Jews dwelling in Egypt may have a place to gather in harmony with one another and thereby serve your interests. For indeed the prophet Isaiah foretold this too: there shall be an altar in Egypt to the Lord God, and he prophesied many other such things concerning this place." This, then, is what Onias wrote to King Ptolemy, and one may observe the piety of him and of Cleopatra his sister and wife from the letter they wrote in reply, for they laid the sin and the transgression of the law upon the head of Onias himself. For they wrote back as follows: "King Ptolemy and Queen Cleopatra to Onias, greetings. We have read your letter asking to be permitted to cleanse the ruined shrine in the city of Leontopolis in the Heliopolite Nome, called that of the wild Bubastes. We are amazed, therefore, that a temple should be pleasing to God when set up in so impure a place and one full of sacred animals. But since you say that the prophet Isaiah foretold this a long time ago, we grant you permission, if this is indeed to be in accordance with the law, so that we may not appear to have committed any sin against God." Having received the place, then, Onias built a temple and an altar to God like the one in Jerusalem, though smaller and poorer. Its dimensions and its furnishings I have not thought it necessary to describe here, for they have been recorded in my 7th book of the Jewish War. And Onias found certain Jews like himself, priests and Levites, to conduct worship there. But concerning this temple enough has now been said by us. Now the Jews of Alexandria, and the Samaritans, who worshipped at the temple on Gerizim, happened in the time of Alexander to quarrel with one another, and they contended before Ptolemy himself about their respective temples, the Jews maintaining that the one in Jerusalem had been built according to the laws of Moses, and the Samaritans that the one on Gerizim had. They asked the king to sit in judgment with his friends and hear the arguments on these matters, and to punish those who lost the case with death. The case for the Samaritans was argued by Sabbeus and Theodosius, and that for the people of Jerusalem and the Jews by Andronicus son of Messalamus. They swore by God and by the king that they would indeed present their proofs according to the law, and they asked Ptolemy that whichever of them he found transgressing the oaths, he should put to death. The king, then, taking many of his friends into his council, sat to hear the arguments of both sides. The Jews then present in Alexandria were greatly anxious for the men, for it distressed them that anyone should try to overthrow the temple in Jerusalem. For they took it hard that some should attempt to destroy a temple so ancient and so renowned throughout the inhabited world. When Sabbeus and Theodosius had granted Andronicus the right to speak first, he began his proofs from the law and from the succession of the high priests, showing how each had received the honor from his father and had presided over the temple, and how all the kings of Asia had honored the temple with dedications and the most splendid gifts, while no one had ever taken any account or notice of the temple on Gerizim, as though it did not even exist. By saying these things, and many others like them, Andronicus persuaded the king to decide that the temple in Jerusalem had been built according to the laws of Moses, and to put to death Sabbeus and Theodosius. Such, then, were the events that befell the Jews of Alexandria in the time of Ptolemy Philometor. And when Demetrius had died in battle, as we have shown above, Alexander, having taken over the kingdom of Syria, wrote to Ptolemy Philometor asking for his daughter's hand in marriage, saying that it was fitting that he, having recovered his father's kingdom and having been advanced to it by the providence of God, and having overcome Demetrius, and being in every other respect not unworthy of kinship with him, should be joined to him by marriage. Ptolemy, receiving the proposal of marriage gladly, wrote back saying he rejoiced that Alexander had recovered his father's kingdom, and promised to give him his daughter, and bade him come to Ptolemais to receive the daughter he was about to bring, for he himself would escort her that far from Egypt and there give the girl in marriage to him. Having written this, Ptolemy came in haste to Ptolemais, bringing his daughter Cleopatra. Finding Alexander there, as he had written, already arrived to meet him, he gave him the girl, along with a dowry of silver and gold as much as it was fitting for a king to give. And while the wedding was being celebrated, Alexander wrote to Jonathan the high priest and ordered him to come to Ptolemais. Jonathan, arriving before the kings and presenting them with gifts, was received with splendid honor from both. Alexander compelled him to take off his own garments and put on the purple, and, having him sit down together with himself on the dais, ordered his commanders to go with him into the middle of the city and proclaim that no one was permitted to speak against him or to cause him trouble. When the commanders had done this, those who had been prepared to accuse Jonathan and were hostile to him, seeing the honor proclaimed for him by the king, fled away, fearing that they too might suffer some harm. So great was the regard King Alexander showed for Jonathan that he had him enrolled first among his friends. Now in the 165th year, Demetrius, son of Demetrius, with many mercenaries which Lasthenes the Cretan had supplied him, set out from Crete and sailed to Cilicia. When Alexander heard of this, he was thrown into anxiety and confusion, and at once hurried from Phoenicia to Antioch in order to secure affairs there before Demetrius arrived. He left Apollonius the Deicite as governor of Celesyria, who, coming to Jamnia with a large force, sent to Jonathan the high priest, saying that it was unjust that he alone should live in security and with full authority, not being subject to the king, that this brought reproach upon him from everyone, that he had not brought Jonathan into subjection to the king. Do not, then, deceive yourself by sitting in the mountains and imagining that you have strength. Rather, if you trust in your own power, come down into the plain and match yourself against our army, and the outcome of the victory will show who is the bravest. Know, too, that the best men from every city march with me. Indeed, these are the very men who have always defeated your ancestors. You will fight your battle against us on such ground that there are no stones with which to defend yourself, only weapons, and no place to which you might flee if defeated. Provoked by this, Jonathan chose 10,000 soldiers and set out from Jerusalem, together with Simon his brother, and, arriving at Joppa, encamped outside the city, the people of Joppa having shut its gates against him, for they had a garrison inside stationed there by Apollonius. But while Jonathan was preparing to besiege them, the people, fearing that, when Apollonius heard that Jaffa had been taken by Jonathan, he took 3,000 cavalry and 8,000 infantry and marched to Ashdod. From there he set out again, moving slowly and deliberately, and on reaching Jaffa he pulled back, drawing Jonathan out onto the plain, confident in his cavalry and expecting an easy victory. Jonathan advanced and pursued Apollonius toward Ashdod. But once the enemy had reached open ground, Apollonius wheeled around and joined battle. He had stationed 1,000 cavalry in ambush in a nearby ravine so that they could appear behind the enemy's lines, but Jonathan noticed them and was not shaken. He drew up his army in a square, facing the enemy on both sides at once, front and rear. As the fighting dragged on until evening, he gave part of his force to his brother Simon and ordered him to engage the enemy's main line, while he himself commanded the rest to lock shields and absorb the cavalry's volleys. His men did as ordered, and although the enemy cavalry kept shooting at them until their quivers were empty, the arrows did no harm. They could not penetrate bodies protected by shields packed so tightly together that the missiles were easily deflected and fell useless. When the enemy had worn themselves out shooting from morning until late afternoon, Simon, seeing that they were exhausted, engaged their infantry line, and with his soldiers fighting eagerly, he routed the enemy. Seeing the infantry in flight, the cavalry did not hold their ground either. Already exhausted from fighting since dawn, and now with no hope of support from their infantry, they fled in disorder and confusion, scattering across the whole plain. Jonathan pursued them all the way to Ashdod, killing many who had given up hope of escape, and forced the rest to take refuge in the Temple of Dagon at Ashdod. Jonathan took the city itself by storm and burned it along with the surrounding villages. He did not spare the Temple of Dagon either, but burned that too, destroying everyone who had fled inside for safety. In all, the enemy dead those killed in battle and those burned in the temple numbered 8,000. Having won so decisive a victory, Jonathan left Ashdod and marched to Ashkelon, and when he camped outside the city, the people of Ashkelon came out to meet him bearing gifts and honoring him. He accepted their goodwill and returned from there to Jerusalem, bringing with him the great quantity of plunder he had taken from the defeated enemy. When Alexander heard that his general Apollonius had been defeated, he pretended to be pleased, on the grounds that Apollonius had fought against his own wishes with Jonathan, who was his friend and ally. He sent word to Jonathan commending him, and granting him honors and rewards a gold clasp, of the kind customarily given to relatives of kings, and assigning him Ekron and its district as his own holding. About this same time, King Ptolemy, surnamed Philometor, arrived in Syria with a naval and land force to support Alexander, since he was his father-in-law. All the cities at Alexander's command welcomed him eagerly and escorted him as far as Ashdod, where the people all cried out against him, denouncing Jonathan for destroying their temple of Dagon, burning their territory, and killing many of their people. Ptolemy heard all this out but said nothing. Jonathan, meanwhile, went to meet Ptolemy at Jaffa, where he received splendid gifts from him and every mark of honor. He then escorted him as far as the river called Eleutherus, before returning again to Jerusalem. When Ptolemy reached Ptolemais, he narrowly escaped assassination quite unexpectedly, since the plot against him came from Alexander himself, carried out through Ammonius, who happened to be his friend. Once the plot came to light, Ptolemy wrote to Alexander demanding that Ammonius be handed over for punishment, saying that he had been the target of the man's scheme, and insisting he answer for it. When Alexander refused to surrender him, Ptolemy realized that Alexander himself was behind the plot and grew bitterly hostile toward him. The people of Antioch, too, already had a grievance against Alexander over Ammonius, since they had suffered greatly at the man's hands. Ammonius did in the end pay the penalty for his crimes. He was slaughtered in disgrace like a woman, having tried to hide himself in women's clothing, as we have related elsewhere. Ptolemy, now regretting that he had given his daughter in marriage to Alexander and joined him in alliance against Demetrius, broke off the family tie. He took his daughter away from Alexander and sent her at once to Demetrius, opening negotiations for an alliance and a marriage. He promised to give Demetrius his daughter as wife and to restore him to his father's kingdom. Demetrius, delighted by this embassy, accepted both the alliance and the marriage. One task alone remained for Ptolemy, to persuade the people of Antioch, who were hostile toward Demetrius on account of the wrongs his father had done them, to accept him. He accomplished this too. The Antiochians, hating Alexander because of Ammonius, as we have said, easily drove him out of Antioch, and he, expelled from the city, fled to Cilicia. Ptolemy then came before the Antiochians and was proclaimed king by them and by the army, and reluctantly assumed two crowns, that of Asia and that of Egypt. But being naturally decent and just, and having no craving for such grandeur, and moreover shrewd enough to foresee what was coming, he judged it wise to avoid arousing the resentment of the Romans. He therefore called the Antiochians to an assembly and persuaded them to accept Demetrius instead, saying that, for the benefits their father had shown him, he would bear the son no grudge on their account. He also pledged that he himself would act as Demetrius's good counselor and guide, and promised not to let him undertake any base course of action, adding that the kingdom of Egypt was enough for him. With these words, he persuaded the Antiochians to accept Demetrius. When Alexander then set out from Cilicia with a large army and great preparations, marched into Syria, and burned and plundered the territory of Antioch, Ptolemy took the field against him together with his son-in-law Demetrius, for he had by now given him his daughter in marriage, and together they defeated Alexander and put him to flight. Alexander fled to Arabia. In the course of the battle, it happened that Ptolemy's horse, startled by the trumpeting of an elephant, threw him off, and when the enemy saw him fall, they rushed at him and struck him with many wounds to the head, bringing him to the point of death. His bodyguards snatched him away, but he was in such a bad state that for 4 days he could neither recognize anyone nor speak. The Arab chief Zabdil cut off Alexander's head and sent it to Ptolemy, who, having by the 5th day recovered enough from his wounds to understand what was set before him, both heard the news of Alexander's death and saw the head the most welcome sight and report he could have received. Not long afterward, filled with joy at Alexander's death, he himself also died. Alexander, surnamed Balas, had reigned over Asia for 5 years, as we have also related elsewhere. Once Demetrius, surnamed Nicator, had taken over the kingdom. In his wickedness, he set about undermining Ptolemy's forces, forgetting the alliance between them and the fact that Ptolemy was his father-in-law and kinsman through the marriage to Cleopatra. Ptolemy's soldiers fled his overtures to Alexandria, and Demetrius took possession of the elephants. Meanwhile, Jonathan, the high priest, gathered an army from all of Judea and laid siege to the Acra in Jerusalem, which held a Macedonian garrison and some renegade Jews who had abandoned their ancestral customs. At first, these men scorned Jonathan's efforts against the fortress, trusting in the strength of the place, but some of the wicked men inside slipped out by night and went to Demetrius, informing him of the siege of the citadel. Enraged by this news, Demetrius took his army and marched from Antioch against Jonathan. On reaching Ptolemais, he wrote ordering him to come to him there at once. Jonathan did not lift the siege, but taking with him the elders of the people, the priests, gold, silver, clothing, and a great quantity of gifts, he went to Demetrius and by these presents won over the king's anger. Honored by him, he secured confirmation of the high priesthood, on the same terms he had held it under the kings before Demetrius. When the exiles brought accusations against him, Demetrius did not believe them. Instead, at Jonathan's request that all Judea and the 3 districts of Samaria, Jaffa, and Galilee should pay 300 talents, he granted this and issued letters covering the whole matter, which read as follows. King Demetrius to his brother Jonathan and to the nation of the Jews, greetings. We are sending you a copy of the letter we wrote to our kinsman Lasthenes concerning you, so that you may be informed of it. King Demetrius to his father Lasthenes, greetings. To the nation of the Jews, being our friend and keeping faith with us, we have decided, out of regard for their goodwill, to grant a favor. We release to them the 3 districts of Ephraim, Lydda, and Ramatime, which were added to Judea from the territory of Samaria, along with everything belonging to them. Likewise, everything that the kings before me received from those who offered sacrifices in Jerusalem, and whatever comes from the produce of the land and from its crops, and all other dues owed to us, together with the salt pools and the crowns brought to us, all of this, we release to them, and none of it shall be revoked from now on for all time. See to it, then, that a copy of this be made and given to Jonathan, and set up in a conspicuous place in the holy temple. Such was the content of the letter. Once Demetrius saw that peace prevailed and there was no danger or fear of war, he disbanded his army and cut its pay, keeping full pay only for the mercenaries who had come up with him from Crete and the other islands. This earned him the hatred and enmity of the soldiers, whom he no longer supported at all, whereas the kings before him had continued to support them even in peacetime, so as to keep their goodwill and have them ready to fight eagerly if ever the need arose. Noticing this resentment of the soldiers toward Demetrius, a certain general of Alexander's, a native of Apamea named Diodatus, also called Trypho, went to Malchus the Arab, who was raising Alexander's son Antiochus, and, informing him of the army's hostility to Demetrius, urged him to hand Antiochus over to him, promising to make him king and restore to him his father's kingdom. Malchus at first resisted, distrusting him, but after Trypho had pressed his suit for a long time, he was won over and yielded to what Trypho urged. Such was the state of affairs concerning this man. Meanwhile, the high priest Jonathan, wanting to force out those in the Acre of Jerusalem, along with the Jewish exiles and renegades and the garrisons throughout the whole country, sent gifts and envoys to Demetrius asking him to expel those in the Judean strongholds. Demetrius promised not only to grant this, but even more once the war he currently had on his hands was settled, since for now he had no time to spare for it. He also asked Jonathan to send him military support, indicating that his own army had deserted him. So Jonathan chose 3,000 soldiers and sent them. The people of Antioch, hating Demetrius for the wrongs he had done them, and hostile to him also on account of his father who had wronged them greatly, were watching for an opportunity to attack him. Learning that Jonathan's reinforcements had arrived to support Demetrius, and realizing that he would gather a large force unless they moved first to seize him, they took up arms, surrounded his palace in the manner of a siege, blocked the exits, and sought to overpower the king. Seeing the people of Antioch in open war against him and under arms, Demetrius took his mercenaries together with the Jewish troops sent by Jonathan and engaged the Antiochians. But overwhelmed by them, for they were many tens of thousands, he was defeated. When the Jews saw the Antiochians gaining the upper hand, they climbed onto the roofs of the palace buildings and shot down at the Antiochians from there. Being at a great height, they themselves suffered nothing from the enemy, while doing them great harm by fighting from above, and they drove the Antiochians back from the houses nearby. They then set those houses on fire at once, and since the buildings were closely packed and mostly built of wood, the flames spread and consumed the entire city. Unable to fight the fire or bring help, the Antiochians turned to flight. As the Jews leapt from rooftop to rooftop in pursuit of them, the chase took on a remarkable character. Seeing the Antiochians intent on saving their children and wives, and therefore no longer fighting, the king attacked them through other side streets, and in the engagement killed many of them, forcing the rest to throw down their weapons and surrender to Demetrius. He forgave them their audacity and put an end to the uprising. He also rewarded the Jews with the spoils taken, and, thanking them as the ones chiefly responsible for his victory, sent them back to Jonathan in Jerusalem with a testimonial of their loyal service. Later, however, he turned base toward Jonathan, went back on his promises, and threatened war unless Jonathan paid him all the tribute that the Jewish nation had owed the earlier kings. He would have carried this out had Trypho not held him back, diverting his preparations against Jonathan by drawing his attention to his own affairs instead. For Trypho, returning from Arabia to Syria with Alexander's boy Antiochus, who was still a mere youth, placed the crown on him. When the whole army that had abandoned Demetrius for lack of pay came over to Antiochus's side, he opened war against Demetrius, engaged him in battle, and defeated him. Jonathan's preparations, which Antiochus had drawn together to move against him, were redirected instead toward his own troubles. For Antiochus, returning from Arabia into Syria with his son Antiochus, the boy was still young in years, placed the diadem on him. When the whole army that had abandoned Demetrius for want of pay came over to him, he opened war against Demetrius, met him in battle, and won the day, capturing both the elephants and the city of the Antiochians. Demetrius, defeated, withdrew into Cilicia, while the boy Antiochus sent envoys and letters to Jonathan, made him his friend and ally, confirmed him in the high priesthood, and ceded to him the four districts that had been added to the territory of the Jews. He further sent him golden vessels and cups, granted him the right to wear purple, gave him a golden clasp, and ranked him among his foremost friends. He also appointed Jonathan's brother Simon general of the forces, from the latter of Tyre to Egypt. Jonathan, delighted at Antiochus's favor toward him, sent envoys to him and to Tryphon and pledged to be their friend and ally, and to make war alongside them against Demetrius, pointing out that he owed Demetrius no gratitude for the many benefits he claimed to have granted, since in every case where Jonathan had needed his help, he had found none, but had instead been wronged in return for the good he had done him. Antiochus therefore allowed him to gather a large force from Syria and Phoenicia to fight Demetrius's generals, and Jonathan set out at once for the cities. They received him splendidly, but gave him no troops. Moving on from there to the city of Ashkelon, where the people of Ashkelon met him eagerly with gifts, he urged them, and every city in Celesyria that revolted from Demetrius, to join Antiochus, and, by fighting alongside him, to try to exact from Demetrius satisfaction for whatever wrongs he had ever done them. There were, he said, many grounds on which they might wish to think this way. Having persuaded the cities to agree to ally themselves with Antiochus, he came on to Gaza, meaning to win their goodwill toward Antiochus as well. But he found the people of Gaza far more hostile than he had expected. They shut their gates against him, and abandoning Demetrius, still refused to go over to Antiochus. This provoked Jonathan to besiege them and ravage their land. Stationing part of his army around Gaza, he went with the rest through the countryside himself, destroying and burning it. Seeing themselves suffering this, and no help coming from Demetrius, but their present distress immediate while any relief was still far off and uncertain whether it would even come, the people of Gaza judged it wise to let go of that hope and attend instead to what lay before them. They therefore sent to Jonathan and pledged friendship and alliance, for men, before they have felt disaster, rarely grasp their own advantage, but once caught in some misfortune, they choose, too late and to their cost, the course that reasoning could have shown them without any harm at all. Jonathan, having made this pact of friendship with them and taken hostages, sent the hostages to Jerusalem, while he himself passed through the whole country as far as Damascus. When he heard that Demetrius's generals had advanced with a large force to Kadesh, which lies between the territory of Tyre and Galilee, for they supposed that this would draw him away from Syria to defend the Galileans, since they assumed he would not overlook his own people being attacked while they were in Galilee. He went to meet them, leaving his brother Simon behind in Judea. Simon, gathering as large a force as the country allowed, laid siege to Bethzur, the strongest fortress in Judea, which a garrison of Demetrius's still held. We have spoken of this place before as well. When Simon had raised earthworks and set up siege engines and was pressing the siege of Bethzur with great energy, the garrison, fearing that if the place were taken by storm they would be destroyed, sent to Simon and asked, on receiving oaths that they would suffer no harm from him, to be allowed to leave the place and withdraw to Demetrius. Simon gave them this pledge, expelled them from the city, and stationed a garrison of his own there. Jonathan, meanwhile, broke camp from Galilee, from the waters called the Waters of Genesaret, for he had been encamped there, and advanced to the plain called Hazor, unaware that the enemy were in it. Learning a day beforehand that Jonathan was about to march against them, Demetrius's men set an ambush for him, stationing men to lie in wait in the hills while they themselves, with the army, went out to meet him on the plain. When Jonathan saw them ready for battle, he too made his own soldiers ready for the contest as best he could. But when the men Demetrius's generals had stationed in ambush came up behind the Jews, they were struck with fear that, caught between the two forces, they would be destroyed, and rushed to flee. All the rest abandoned Jonathan, but a few, about 50 in number, with Mattathias son of Absalom and Judas son of Chalphi, commanders of the whole force, pressed forward boldly and in desperation against the enemy, and by their daring struck them with terror and turned them to flight with their own hands. When the men of Jonathan's army who had withdrawn saw the enemy routed, they rallied from their flight and set out in pursuit, chasing them as far as Kadesh, where the enemy's camp had been. Jonathan, having won this brilliant victory and killed 2,000 of the enemy, returned to Jerusalem. Seeing that everything was going according to his wishes by God's providence, he sent envoys to the Romans to renew the friendship that had earlier existed between the nation and them, and instructed the same envoys, on their way back from Rome, to visit the Spartans and remind them of the friendship and kinship between them. When the envoys reached Rome, they came before the Senate, delivered Jonathan the high priest's message, that he had sent them to confirm the alliance, and the Senate ratified what it had earlier decreed concerning friendship with the Jews and gave them letters to carry to all the kings of Asia and Europe and to the rulers of the cities, so that they might have safe passage home through their territories. On their way back, they came to Sparta and delivered to the Spartans the letters they had received from Jonathan. This was a copy of it. Jonathan, the high priest of the nation of the Jews, and the Senate and the body of priests, to the ephors and senate and people of the Lacedaemonians, our brothers, greeting. If you and your public and private affairs are prospering, it is as we would wish. We too are well. In earlier times, when a letter was brought to Onias, who was then high priest among us, from Arius, who was king of your people, through Demodals, concerning the kinship existing between us, a copy of which is appended below, we received the letter gladly and were well disposed toward Demodals and Arius, though we had no need of such proof, since it was already a matter of trust from our sacred writings. Still, we did not think it right to be the first to claim the connection, for fear of seeming to snatch for ourselves the honor you offer. And now, though much time has passed since that kinship was first renewed for us, In our sacred and appointed days, we offer sacrifice to God and remember you, praying for your safety and victory. Though many wars have surrounded us because of the greed of our neighbors, we judged it right to trouble neither you nor any other of our connections. But having overcome our enemies, we sent Numenius son of Antiochus and Antipater son of Jason, men held in honor among our Senate, to the Romans, and through them we also sent letters to you, so that our kinship with you might be renewed. You will therefore do well to write to us as well, and to let us know whatever you may need, since we stand ready to further your purposes in every way. The Lacedaemonians received the envoys warmly, and having passed a decree concerning alliance and friendship, sent it to them. About this time there were three schools of thought among the Jews, which held differing views concerning human affairs. One was called that of the Pharisees, another that of the Sadducees, and the third that of the Essenes. The Pharisees say that some things, but not all, are the work of fate, and that some things lie within our own power, whether they happen or not. The school of the Essenes declares that fate is sovereign over everything, and that nothing at all befalls men except by its decree. The Sadducees, on the other hand, do away with fate altogether, holding that it does not exist, and that human affairs do not reach their end according to it, but that everything lies within our own power, so that we ourselves are the cause both of the good things that come to us and of the misfortunes we bring on ourselves through our own poor judgment. But I have given a more precise account of these matters in the second book of my work on Jewish affairs. Demetrius's generals, wishing to avenge their defeat, gathered a larger force than before and marched against Jonathan. Learning of their advance, he moved swiftly to meet them in the region of Hamath, unwilling to give them the leisure to invade Judea. Encamping 50 stadia from the enemy, he sent men to observe their camp and how they had positioned themselves. When his scouts reported everything to him, and had also captured, by night, some men who disclosed that the enemy intended to attack, he took precautions in advance, setting outposts outside the camp and keeping his whole force under arms through the entire night, having instructed them to be resolute in spirit and prepared in mind to fight even by night if need be, so that their intention should not go unnoticed by the enemy. When Demetrius's generals learned that Jonathan knew of their plan, they were no longer of sound mind, but were thrown into confusion at having been discovered by the enemy, and at having no hope of prevailing now that their plot had failed in every other respect, for they did not think themselves a match for Jonathan's men in open combat. They therefore resolved on flight, and lighting many fires so that the enemy, seeing them, would suppose they had stayed, withdrew. But Jonathan, advancing on their camp at dawn and finding it empty, understood that they had fled and pursued them. He did not, however, manage to overtake them, for they had already crossed the Eleutherus River and were in safety. Turning back from their toward Arabia, he made war on the Nabataeans, drove off a great quantity of their plunder, and, taking captives, went to Damascus and sold everything there. At about the same time, his brother Simon, having passed through the whole of Judea and secured Palestine as far as Ashkelon with garrisons, and having made these places, along with their buildings, very strong and well guarded, came to Joppa, and, seizing it, brought in a large garrison, for he had heard that the people of Joppa intended to hand over the city to Demetrius's generals. Having settled these matters, Simon and Jonathan came to Jerusalem. Jonathan, gathering the whole people into the temple, took counsel with them to repair the walls of Jerusalem, to rebuild what had been torn down of the wall around the temple, and to strengthen its surroundings with high towers. And in addition, to build another wall through the middle of the city, so as to cut off the garrison in the citadel from access to the city, and in this way, shut them off from a ready supply of provisions. And further, to make the fortresses throughout the countryside far stronger than their present state of security allowed. When the people had approved this plan as sound, Jonathan himself carried out the building work in the city, while he sent Simon out to secure the countryside. Demetrius, meanwhile, crossed into Mesopotamia, intending to seize both it and Babylon, and, once master of the upper satrapies, to use them as a base for laying claim to the whole kingdom. For the Greeks and Macedonians settled there kept sending envoys to him, promising that if he came to them, they would hand themselves over to him and join him in warring down Arsaces, king of the Parthians. Lifted up by these hopes, he set out to join them, resolved, once he had subdued the Parthians and gained an army, to make war on Tryphon and drive him out of Syria. The people of the country received him eagerly, and, gathering a force, he made war on Arsaces. But he lost his whole army and was himself taken alive, as has also been related elsewhere. When Tryphon learned that things had ended in this way for Demetrius, he was no longer loyal to Antiochus, but plotted to kill him and seize the kingdom for himself. What stood in the way of this design was his fear of Jonathan, who was a friend of Antiochus. And for this reason, he resolved to get Jonathan out of the way first, and only then to move against Antiochus's party. Having decided to destroy him by trickery and deceit, he went from Antioch to Bethshean, called by the Greeks Scythopolis, and Jonathan came to meet him there with 40,000 picked troops, supposing that Tryphon had come to fight him. When Tryphon saw that Jonathan was ready for battle, he tried to win him over with gifts and displays of friendliness, and ordered his own commanders to obey Jonathan, wishing by these means to establish his goodwill and to remove every suspicion, so as to catch him off his guard, careless and foreseeing nothing, once he had been lulled into contempt. He advised him to dismiss his army, since there was no need to keep it under arms now, with no war on and the situation at peace. He urged him, however, to keep a few men about him and come with them to Tolmais, for he would hand over the city to him, along with all the other strongholds throughout the country, and would do so on Jonathan's account. Indeed, he said, this was the very purpose of his visit. Jonathan, suspecting none of this, but trusting, out of goodwill and honest judgment, that Tryphon's advice was sincerely meant, dismissed his army, keeping back only 3,000 men, of whom Trypho left 2,000 men in Galilee and went on with the remaining 1,000 to Tolmais, taking Jonathan with him. But the people of Tolmais shut the gates, for this had been ordered them by Trypho beforehand, and seized Jonathan alive while killing all who were with him. Trypho then sent men against the 2,000 left behind in Galilee to destroy them as well. These men, however, warned by rumor of what had happened to Jonathan, managed to arm themselves and leave the country before Trypho's agents could reach them. The men sent against them, seeing them ready to fight for their lives, did them no harm and returned to Trypho. When the people of Jerusalem heard of Jonathan's arrest and the destruction of the soldiers with him, they mourned bitterly for the man and searched anxiously for news of him everywhere. And a great fear, reasonably enough, fell upon and troubled them, that now that Jonathan's courage and foresight had been taken from them, the surrounding nations, who had been hostile to them but kept quiet on his account, would rise against them and force them into the utmost danger by making war. And indeed what they suspected came to pass. Hearing of Jonathan's death, the neighboring nations began making war on the Jews as men without a leader. Trypho himself gathered an army with the intention of marching up into Judea and warring on its people. Simon, seeing the people of Jerusalem terrified at this, wished to make them bolder, and called the people together at the temple to address them. "You are not unaware, countrymen, that my father and my brothers and I willingly dared to die for your freedom. Since I have such examples before me, and men of our own house who died for the laws and our worship, no fear will ever be great enough to drive that resolve from my soul and replace it with love of life or contempt for honor. So then, as men who do not lack a leader able to suffer and to do the greatest things on your behalf, follow me eagerly wherever I lead. For I am no better than my brothers that I should spare my own life, nor am I inferior to them that I should shrink from and abandon what they judged most noble, to die for the laws and the worship of God. Where I must show myself their true brother, I will prove myself a brother to them indeed. I am confident that I will exact justice from our enemies and rescue all of you, with your wives and children, from their outrage, and that with God's help I will keep the temple from being plundered. For I see that the nations, thinking you have no leader, have grown contemptuous of you and are eager for war." When Simon had spoken these words, the people took heart. Their spirits, which had sunk in cowardice, were roused to a better and confident hope, so that the whole people cried out together that Simon should lead them, taking the place of his brothers Judas and Jonathan, and that they would obey whatever he commanded. He at once gathered every man fit for war among his own forces and hurried to rebuild the city walls, securing them with very high and strong towers. he sent a friend of his, Jonathan the son of Absalom, with an army to Joppa, ordering him to expel its inhabitants, for he feared they might hand the city over to Trypho. He himself remained behind to guard Jerusalem. Trypho set out from Ptolemais with a large army and came into Judea, bringing Jonathan with him in chains. Simon met him with his own forces at the town of Adida, which lies on a hill overlooking the plains of Judea. Learning that Simon had been made leader by the Jews, Trypho sent to him, wishing to deceive and outmaneuver him. He told Simon that if he wished his brother Jonathan released, he should send 100 talents of silver and 2 of Jonathan's sons as hostages, so that once freed he would not lead Judea to revolt from the king, for Jonathan, he said, was being held bound because of money he owed the king from a loan. Simon was not ignorant of Trypho's trick. He understood that if he gave the money he would lose it and still not free his brother, and would besides hand over the boys to the enemy along with him. Yet, fearing he would be blamed by the people as the one responsible for his brother's death, since he had given neither the money nor the sons on his behalf, he gathered the army and told them what Trypho demanded, saying that it concealed a trap and a plot. Nevertheless, it was preferable to send the money and the sons than to refuse Trypho's demands and be blamed for having been unwilling to save his brother. So Simon sent off both Jonathan's sons and the money. But Trypho, once he had received them, did not keep his word. He neither freed Jonathan nor released the sons, but took his army and marched around the country, having decided to go up to Jerusalem next by way of Idumea. He advanced as far as Adora, a town of Idumea, with Simon always moving parallel to him and encamping opposite. When those in the citadel sent to Trypho urging him to hurry to them and send provisions, he prepared his cavalry to be in Jerusalem that very night. But heavy snow fell during the night, covering the roads and making the march impassable for horses because of its depth, and this prevented him from reaching Jerusalem. For this reason Trypho set out from there and came into Celesyria. Hastening into Gilead, he killed Jonathan there and ordered him buried, then returned to Antioch. Simon sent to the town of Basca and had his brother's bones brought back, and buried them at Modin, their native place, and the whole people made great mourning for him. Simon built a very great monument for his father and brothers out of white, polished stone, raising it to a great and conspicuous height, and set up porticos around it, and erected monolithic columns, a wonder to behold, and besides these built 7 pyramids, one for each of his parents and brothers, made to inspire awe by their size and beauty, monuments that survive to this day. Such, we know, was the devotion shown by Simon's family to Jonathan's burial and the building of these monuments. Jonathan died after serving 4 years as high priest and leader of the nation. So much for the circumstances of his death. Simon, established as high priest by the people, in the first year of his high priesthood, freed the nation from servitude to the Macedonians, so that they no longer paid them tribute. This freedom and exemption from tribute came to the Jews after 170 years from the time Seleucus, called Nicator, had taken possession of Syria. So great was the people's devotion to Simon that in their contracts with one another and in public documents they wrote, in the first year, of Simon, benefactor and ethnarch of the Jews. For under him they prospered greatly and overcame the enemies around them. Simon subdued the cities of Gazara, Joppa, and Jamnia, and after besieging and taking the citadel in Jerusalem, raised it to the ground, so that it might not serve as a base for enemies to occupy and use to harm the city, as it had before. Having done this, he judged it best and most advantageous also to level the hill on which the citadel had stood, so that the temple might be higher than everything around it. He persuaded the people of this by calling an assembly and reminding them of what they had suffered from the garrison and from the Jewish exiles, and what they would suffer again if a foreign garrison were ever established there once more, should the kingdom fall back into enemy hands. By saying this, he persuaded the people, urging on them what was to their advantage. All of them together set to work leveling the hill, and never resting from the labor by night or day, over 3 full years brought it down level with the plain. From then on the temple stood out above everything, once the citadel and the hill on which it stood had been demolished. Such was the course of events under Simon. Not long afterward, Trypho, acting as his guardian, murdered Antiochus the son of Alexander, who was also called the God. after he had reigned 4 years, and announced that he had died under medical treatment. Trypho then sent his closest friends to the soldiers, promising them great sums of money if they would proclaim him king, telling them that Demetrius had been taken captive by the Parthians, and that his brother Antiochus, if he came to power, would do them great harm in revenge for their revolt. The soldiers, hoping to profit from the kingdom given to Trypho, declared him ruler. But once Trypho had gained control of affairs, he revealed his true, wicked nature. As a private citizen, he had courted the people and feigned moderation, using it to draw them toward whatever he wanted. But once he had taken the kingship, he cast off the pretense, and the real Trypho stood revealed. Through this, he made his enemies stronger, for the army, hating him, deserted to Cleopatra, the wife of Demetrius, who was then shut up with her children in Seleucia. And when Antiochus, Demetrius's brother, called Soter, was wandering about with no city willing to receive him because of Trypho, Cleopatra sent for him, inviting him to marriage and to the kingship, partly because his friends had persuaded her to it, and partly because she feared that some in Seleucia would hand the city over to Trypho. Once Antiochus had come to Seleucia, and his strength grew daily, he set out to make war on Trypho, and defeating him in battle, drove him out of Upper Syria into Phoenicia, pursuing him as far as Dora, a fortress hard to capture, where he besieged him after Trypho had taken refuge there. He also sent envoys to Simon, the high priest of the Jews, concerning friendship and alliance. Simon eagerly welcomed his request, and sent much money and provisions to the soldiers besieging Dora, supplying Antiochus generously, so that for a short time he was counted among his most essential friends. Trypho, fleeing from Dora to Apamia, was captured there under siege and died, after reigning 3 years. Antiochus, out of greed and baseness, forgot the services Simon had rendered him in his time of need, and, putting an army under the command of his friend Cendebeus, sent him to ravage Judea and capture Simon. Simon, hearing of Antiochus's lawlessness, though already an old man, was roused by the injustice of Antiochus's actions, and, taking on a spirit greater than his years, commanded the war with youthful vigor.